Welcome to A More Beautiful Life Collective. We know that in the hectic hurry of everyday life, it's easy to lose sight of what really matters. This is a moment to pause and realign your focus on the one who gives us peace and rest. We are focusing on discipleship, productivity, and homemaking as we live with eternity in mind. This is the place where you'll learn to create a life you love and cultivate your heart for God. Hey everyone, and welcome to A More Beautiful Life Collective podcast. I'm Casey Fletcher, and this is season 1, episode 13. Today, we are going to be focusing on a habit that all of us probably feel like we should do, but a few of us actually do. There's a lot of guilt and a heavy feelings of shoulda, woulda, coulda, but I'm not gonna. So today, I'm going to give you some tips and tricks to cut through all of that noise and gunk and just focus on creating a practice that will renew your mind and help you cultivate a life you love. This is the first of a two-part series on this habit. And what is the habit? A habit that could promise so much? Well, it's the habit of reading. Now wait, don't skip over the podcast yet, because I'm going to give you some insights into something that will be revolutionary in your personal growth. So on the blog a few months ago, I wrote about morning routines. And in the post, I wrote that one of the key habits of successful CEOs and entrepreneurs is to wake up every day at 5 a.m. Another key habit of successful people is to read voraciously. Business Insider wrote about the reading habits of 9 of the world's most successful people, including Oprah Winfrey, Warren Buffett, and Elon Musk. All had a daily habit of reading. A common theme throughout all of these people was the habit to read widely for information and to continue growing in their field and their understanding of others. So books were an avenue to bettering themselves and becoming leaders in their field. They were driven and they kept that drive even after they made it to the top. Now, this is kind of interesting. I think most of you listening are going to fall into one of two camps, right? So you're going to have the people who read all the time. You know that reading is important. Reading is something that you do to unwind, something you do for information, and you just genuinely enjoy it. And then there's the other group. You guys are the people that say, reading's boring, I'm not really interested, I'm okay. And some of you guys may already be tempted to kind of just turn this episode off because you know that you don't like to read and there's no real reason to listen to people talk about reading. But what we're going to talk about today is going to give you some insight into the benefits that reading can have for you and for your life. And it may help you realize that it's not that successful people just have more time, so they're finding, you know, random hobbies like reading to fill their time. I think that reading is the thing that's helping them to be successful. So in this, you know, it's the kind of the chicken or the egg question or situation. In this situation, I think that reading causes people to think more deeply and in general be more successful because of the information and the insight that reading can give to people. It's interesting though. We currently live in a world that's more literate than ever before. From a young age, people are laser focused on getting their children to read. I know, I have a almost 4-year-old and an almost 1.5-year-old. And for both of them, you go around and you see all of the toys, all of the books, the workbooks, the shows, almost all of them are focused on teaching kids the alphabet, teaching kids how to sound out words, basically getting kids to the point that they know how to read. There's so many programs, games, apps, preschools, and videos that sing the alphabet song so that the kids are going to know all the things that they know to get started to read. Schools are pressured to get children reading as soon as possible. Parents make a point to read to their children every day as a toddler and a young child. And it's considered a moral failing if you don't. I know that I feel like I need to read to my kids every day. And I think it's a good thing. This is not a bad thing that we feel this way. But it's almost like our kids are born to be able to read, so that their main purpose is to get to the point where they can read. It's like first they need to walk, then they need to read, and then I guess maybe the next goal, the next purpose that they have is to graduate school and get a job. But what's interesting is we have this culture that emphasizes reading so much, or at least knowing their letters, being literate. But at the same time, we hear some of the facts that I'm about to read you. In 2022, Gallup released a poll showing a decline in the number of adults who are reading books in a year. 18% of the population reads no books in a year. And the amount of time that Americans spend daily reading is less than 30 minutes, which we know is skewed on average because you have people like me who read quite a bit, and then you have some people that read none. And so they lift the average for everybody. So in sum, Americans are reading less than ever before. And statistics on our kids and reading are no better. Only 51% of kids are reading for pleasure or for fun. 27 of eighth graders nationwide are reading below grade level. Illiteracy is one of the major factors in whether a kid drops out of school or not. And we all know that if you drop out of school, life outcomes generally start to have a more negative outlook. For some anecdotal evidence, I can attest that kids just don't read books like they used to, even 15 years ago when I was in school. As a reading teacher, English teacher, I gave my students time to read in class for fun. And so they could just pick whatever they wanted. We called it SSR or independent reading time. Several kids would make a joke that they don't read. You know, you say, get out your books. I'm like, yeah, I don't read. Or they would always say, oh, I haven't finished a book since I was in fourth grade and I taught seventh graders. You could generally tell non-readers in behavior and test scores too. Generally, if a kid was going to make those jokes, they also acted worse in class and they would really struggle with what we were doing in class and with tests and things like that. At the end of the year during standardized testing, kids could bring a book or sleep after the test was done. So you'll have some kids that will take 3 hours on a test and some kids that are finished in 45 minutes. Generally, we want kids to take longer, but they would still have, you know, 30 minutes to an hour, even if they really took their time and did a good job. And so these kids, you know, they're sitting for 2 hours, and even then they would refuse to read a book. Some would rather just sit and stare at the wall instead of doing anything or reading. And that's just kind of mind-boggling for me. See, as a kid, I was a voracious reader. I basically never left anywhere without a book. You know, in a movie or a TV show where the kid is walking down the hall reading a book while they were walking? Yeah, that was me. I did that. Me and a couple of my friends. I read through mostly fantasy and adventure series in middle school. I still really like those. In high school, I actually started to read a little bit more higher level stuff, you know. So I read quite a few Christian books, lots of Christian self-help books, but I also enjoyed the classics like Jane Austen and the Bronte sisters. And interestingly, that growth in reading that actually began in my ninth grade year. So my youth group had a challenge to read through the New Testament. And if we read through the whole thing, we would get a prize. So after I did that, my reading kind of took off. It's crazy, you know, if you invest the time in reading, you know, especially for your kids, if you invest the time in daily reading and reading things that are a little bit more higher level, you really can start to read a lot more widely and faster. And so you'll grow a lot in your reading ability and level. So by my senior year, I was choosing, you know, out of any book that existed, I don't really know why I chose this, but I did, and I did it, and I did it well. But I chose to write my term paper for an English course on Anna Karenina, which is like a 1,000-page tome by Dostoevsky. And so whenever I was figuring out what to do for college, it just seemed natural to pick secondary English education as a career path. It was kind of a natural extension of my love for reading and writing. It wasn't until I got to college that I realized that the world that reading can open up for you. I was talking with a friend recently about how so much of our experiences are wasted on youth. That's the saying, right? Education is wasted on the young. Because of curriculum guides and cultural pressure, we read through some of the best things that culture can offer. Well, hopefully. But that mostly depends on, you know, the type of schooling you're exposed to. But as a child, as a teenager, how can we really know how to appreciate East of Eden or The Great Gatsby or Jane Austen or Charles Dickens? Most of our teachers, they just flung great literature at us and then gave us a due date for when it should be done. And we didn't care and we didn't have a reason to start caring. And you know, this is a recipe for animosity. It's a recipe for readers to begin to hate reading. And you might be nodding your head along with me and saying, yes, I felt that way. And you know, it could have been in middle school, in high school, or even in college where, you know, you might have read so much that you were just done and you were okay. If you never picked up a book, you were okay with that. And I think that this is the great dichotomy of the modern era. We are all literate, but we choose to be illiterate. We choose to not read. We have access to a whole world of information at our fingertips, but we choose to not interact with it, to not learn and grow. And instead, we just allow social media and news to be our primary sifters of information as it spoon feeds us through scrolling and the algorithm. When I got to college, I began to read even more. So college level English classes, for those of you, you know, you have English 101, that generally you'll read maybe a couple novels and then lots of short stories. But once you get into the upper level college English classes, you're generally averaging a book a week. So, you know, if I'm taking three or four English classes, which I did, you know, I was reading at least four books a week, which I actually read. You know, I'm not the type that spark notes things. I'm the type that wants to finish everything. So I did do that. And I also started to dive into other books that I heard about in my classes, as well as the classics that everybody should read. And I will tell you that because I read widely, not just what was on the syllabus, I learned way more through my own reading, as well as podcasts and things I listened to, than I ever did from any one class. And, you know, why is that? Why would it be that a class, so someone who's piecing together all the information for you and creating a distinct thought or connecting threads through several disparate pieces of information, why would that not be as beneficial as reading and listening to, you know, seemingly random pieces of information? And I would say it's because I'm doing the thinking myself. I'm doing the connecting myself. As Charlotte Mason says, people are capable of making pretty profound connections if they're just able to have a wide feast of ideas to read and listen to and digest. So I was recently reading a book called The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains by Nicholas Carr. It was written in 2009, which is a long time ago in technology years, and it described the changes that the author was already beginning to see at that time in the way that our brains worked. He particularly focuses on the way that tools change the way we think. So he used the clock, which I didn't even realize this. The clock and time itself was invented back during the beginning of the monastery. So they had strict codes of time. So they had to wake up, you know, sometimes even in the middle of the night, but first thing in the morning and then in the middle of the day and at noon. And what they would have to do at these set times is they would have to gather together and pray, or they would have to pray in their rooms. And so because of this strict time of prayer, they had to invent a way that everybody could do that at the same time. Because before then they could have used, you know, sometimes they did this, but they would have to use, you know, a sundial or something like that. And it wouldn't always be at that exact time, or they might not have access to it. And so they invented, you know, clocks. And with the invention of the clock, the world ended up eventually being changed. And we can even feel that now, how time controls us, even when we go through things like daylight savings time. Our bodies expect one thing, and we yearn for more light at the end of the day, but the clock is a harsh master and refuses to change its ticking. I can see this with my kids. You know, daylight savings time is great whenever, you know, fallback is great whenever you don't have kids and you can sleep in an extra hour. But whenever you have kids, you're up at, you know, if they normally wake up at 6, you're up at 5 o'clock in the morning and they're not going back to bed. And then their nap schedule get all thrown off. So we can feel how time affects us. And time is such an arbitrary thing. Our bodies work by the way that the sun rises and sets. But because of time, we have to say, okay, I don't care what my body feels. I'm going to do what the clock says. And all of this is because the clock is a technology. He also talks about like a map, whenever we think of like a GPS, we think of these places around us and we don't really think of like the actual lay of the land. Instead, we think of the way, you know, our GPS takes us, the way roads work. And so our whole understanding of the world and our perception of the world is really dictated by these technologies that are created. The internet is a technology that's similarly changing us now. In ancient times, we were a primarily oral culture. So you could think of like Beowulf and myths. You know, stories were passed down through generations and they kept alive wisdom and culture. So with the invention of writing, much of that wisdom was preserved. But it wasn't until the book was created, or also called the codex, that a primarily scribal culture was born. So whereas an oral culture used stories, you know, they have these epithets and repetitive kind of recursive speech where they might say, you know, I don't remember what Beowulf was, but like Beowulf the Mighty or something like that. And then that would trigger your brain to remember the rest of the story. Instead of it being like this, if you can write something down, you can write down really increasingly complex ideas because you can go back and read what you wrote, and reading what you wrote makes you think of something else, and then you write that thing down. And so they were able to think about their thoughts, and that created more complex thoughts. And so information, it exploded with the advent of the printing press, which led to the Reformation and the Industrial Revolution and to our modern day society. One interesting observation in the book, so In the Shallows by Nicholas Carr, was the very nature of independent reading, which came about centuries after the first codex was created in around 60 AD. It created this idea of a private conversation between the reader and the author. So what I mean by that is before, whenever you had a oral culture, obviously you're talking and listening. And so that's very public. Like you at least have two people, but generally you would have, you know, a group of people kind of, you know, think of like a fairy tale or something like that. Like you sit down and you tell the story and it's normally to multiple people. The story can change over time, but it generally has like this truth that you're hearing through it. So it's the same thing that happened with, you know, the story in Genesis. Like you have these stories that get passed down, but sometimes they can play kind of like a telephone game. And that's why, you know, a lot of fairy tales, there's lots of different versions. But there's a central truth in all of that. What's different with a book is that the book, whenever it first was created, generally what you would do is you would read aloud the story. So you can think of in the Bible, you had the letters that Paul wrote. So Paul was writing, but he wasn't writing to just one specific person. Instead, he was writing to a church, and he was writing for the purpose of lots of people listening. It's kind of like me writing this podcast. You know, I'm writing it, but I'm not writing it specifically for one person. I'm thinking of it being listened to by a whole host of people. But the thing about a book as it goes on is that it becomes a very independent, private thing. And that happens a little bit later. So as, you know, universities were being created, think of like, you know, early Middle Ages, that time period, people started to read in their minds. So before they would read out loud, and that's kind of what you did. So you literally can see, you know, you have this like lectern, the whole idea of a lectern where you have like this pedestal, a pulpit. You would have a book on a lectern and somebody would be reading out loud. But then over time, that technology changed, and instead you read it in your mind. And so it became a very private thing where you are reading the author's thoughts and then you are dealing with that. But that kind of also opened the door where people could really be a little bit kind of controversial in what they talked about. And so the reader would have to wrestle with those things. And so it kind of gave them, you know, a little bit more license to think freely and kind of push the envelope. And you can see how that affected thought and philosophy as you go on, because that led to things like the Scientific Revolution and, you know, some of the ideas in the Renaissance and some of the philosophy that led to, you know, the United States and things like that, the philosophy behind that. So I think this independent reading, it opened the door to the highly independent culture that we have today, and much of the political thought that we have today. So it was a mental wrestling with ideas that at the height of the technology of the book that produced the philosophy behind the 99th Thesis, the Declaration of Independence, and Shakespeare. So why does this matter to us today? Well, with the radio and TV and ultimately the internet, we're moving more back in time to this oratory culture of the past. So as people choose to not read and they're choosing to go online more and more, which that is a true fact. Jen Twenge's book, iGen, which we talked about a little bit in our podcast on technology, describes that the only thing really different between Gen Xers, millennials, and iGen at the same age, so different between, you know, teenage Gen Xers and teenage millennials and teenage iGens, is that iGen is spending much more time online and on social media or playing video games than previous generations did as teens. And honestly, we probably all, you know, obviously Gen Xers didn't spend time online as teens, but obviously they're also spending a lot of time online now. So we're all spending more time online, not just iGen. But as we do this, we're getting away from the scribal culture and we're moving towards a more oratory culture. And why? Well, it's because the internet itself is a very social space and we think more shallowly. We don't have the time to just sit down with a book and pause and think. Instead, we're always trying to make ourselves receive information faster and get more information and go into the next thing. And a lot of times too, we also want to talk back. And so because of that, we're not having that time to sit in our own thoughts. I mean, you can even think about this. You know, I listen to my podcast on, you know, at least 1.5, sometimes on times 2 speed, so that you're getting more and more information. Or if you're on social media, you're looking at social media and you're reading through the comments. And so whenever you post on social media, a lot of people are doing their thinking on social media. So they're writing a post about what they think about something and they might be getting a thought, but they're always understanding that somebody is going to read this. And so they may censor their thoughts because they're speaking into a social space. And that is something that you might not do if you're reading and understanding something through with a book or through a journal that is just yours. It's also interesting, you know, with the arrival of AI, you know, we are, we're making meaning and understanding our world through these online conversations. And, you know, with AI too, we're also asking, you know, Google for an answer and Google is just giving it to us and we're just accepting that. And so we're not thinking more deeply and trying to figure out the why behind things. We're just accepting it because there's so much information in the world. Now, some people might say that we're actually reading more than ever because the internet and social media is a very print-based medium. Not all of them are. You know, you have TikToks and things, so some of that is really going away, and you could see that oratory nature in, you know, Snapchat and TikTok and YouTube, where people are talking at you instead of you reading something. And so with that, we are really getting back to, you know, memes by themselves are, you know, examples of this kind of recursive nature of an oratory culture. But even whenever it comes to things like blogs and, you know, Wikipedia, things like that, Carr says that most people only spend about 10 seconds or less on a webpage. So most blog posts, because of SEO and different things like this, and my podcast, you know, the transcript for this podcast included, are roughly 1,500 to 3,000 words. So that really should take, I mean, you know, I'm talking through this and it's going to be about 30 minutes. If you're reading it, you could probably read it in about 7 to 10 minutes, you know, if you read fast, but you can't read that in 10 seconds. So we're skimming online and we're not reading closely. And obviously we're also not thinking deeply about it. It's just a very different reading experience than reading a print book. Another interesting point that I read is whenever, especially these are statistics that I know as an English teacher, but there's a disparity between boys and girls when it comes to reading. And generally, girls read more. They enjoy reading more. Their test scores on reading are higher. And they also generally have better behavior in school overall because of that. There's a book called The Read Aloud Handbook by Jim Trelease, and it talks about this. His hypothesis for why boys are not as into reading as girls is actually related to sports, which I think is interesting. So it's not sports as in playing sports, though I think that could be related to it, but it's actually the rise of televised sports. So you could think of what, which, you know, I didn't experience this, but, you know, fathers before televised sports, they were seen reading the afternoon newspaper, working around the house, maybe even reading aloud from a favorite novel or, you know, Bible at night. But then with the rise of televised sports, that kind of changed. And so TV was brought into the household and brought sports into the household. And that became the thing that you were doing. And you also had to stay up late. So, you know, if you were watching a Monday night football game or Sunday night football game, you know, you're staying up till 11 o'clock and then kids are supposed to wake up in the morning and make it to school and pay attention, you know, at 7 o'clock in the morning. And so they're not getting enough sleep because if a game ends at 11, you know, they're not going to sleep at a decent time. He said this, that many boys end up in children's remedial reading classes, not because they have learning disabilities, but father disabilities. Their fathers, he said, teach them that the really important things in life are things we throw and catch. You do not see me, the average father, get excited about Charlotte's Web, the E.B. White classic. So, you know, that is a quote that definitely ruffles some feathers, but it's just interesting. And I think really what it comes down to, because you could say this too about, you know, prioritizing sports over going to church on Sundays. I think sports can be a valuable thing. We watch football, lots of football, but I think you need to really question what you are prioritizing in your life. Are you prioritizing the act of learning and growing or the act of consuming and being entertained? So why is this important? Well, the very nature of our faith is based on the word being a living and active. Through the Bible, we can see the life-changing power of deep conversations that happen between an author and a reader. We can recognize as well that there's something very different about your understanding of a text when you take the time to read and digest it alone, away from the noise and pressure of social life, as compared to making meaning through a class or sermon when someone's there and telling you their interpretation and reading that text to you. I think part of the proliferation of the Bible and as a result of the Christian faith was that the Codex was just coming into being. So it's interesting that the rise of secular, almost pagan ideology of modern day life coincides with the demise of the book. We are a people of the book, and so we need to recognize and affirm that the power that reading can have over our lives. Our daily quiet time with God and the practice of reading the Bible regularly, individually, should be an utmost priority in our lives. So, we know that. But why should we read other books? I've had several people tell me, it's like, yeah, I like reading the Bible, but whenever it comes to other books, I just don't have the time for it. I don't think it's important. I think it's boring, whatever. I actually had one of the ladies I student taught with back in the day, she told me, I walked in, you know, I'm like, hey, I'm, you know, an English major. I'm excited to be an English teacher. And of course, I love to read. And she looked at me and she said, oh, you like to read? I don't. And she said that in front of all of her students. So all of these kids that she wanted them to sit down, she actually had them do independent reading every day for 30 minutes. And she looked at them on the first day that I came into her class and told all those kids, yeah, I don't really like to read. It's like, okay, well, what are you thinking? What do you think these kids are going to do? And so, you know, you hear this saying and it's like, is that true? And Ecclesiastes 12, 11 through 12 does say this. It says, the words of the wise are like goads. They're collected sayings like firmly embedded nails given by one shepherd. Be warned, my son, of anything in addition to them. Of making many books, there is no end. And much study wearies the body. So yes, there's some truth to the fact that reading too much and idolizing the pursuit of knowledge can lead to worthless living. Perhaps that was one of the reasons that Solomon ended up living the life he did. He was given wisdom by God, just like we're given wisdom in the Bible. But he didn't trust that wisdom he was given. So instead, he spent his life trying to pursue true wisdom. And the great irony was that he already had it. That the sum of the matter was to fear God and keep his commandments. So does this mean that we shouldn't pursue reading anything or learning anything? No, I don't believe that. I think knowledge can be an idol, yes, but I also believe that knowledge is something that we've been given. And as long as we keep it in its rightful place, just like we've been talking about with several other areas of our life, reading and the knowledge that we can learn from it can be a life-giving pursuit that helps us to glorify God. Most of the ideas and concepts that I talk about in my podcast, they're not my own. I didn't come up with these. They come out of me entering into the great conversation that authors are having all around me. And they come out of the fact that I have a vibrant reading life. So I can use what I've learned to make connections and teach others and to have a more purposeful, intentional life. And so reading truly, it makes me a better person. So the last point that I have, it might be a little bit contradictory to what I spoke about concerning, you know, the shallows, but one thing that can give you purpose and kind of help you to navigate your reading life is to understand this fact. It's that whenever you read, you're entering into a conversation. Just like we talked about before, that it's a conversation between an author and a reader. But even more than that, you're entering into the great conversation. So this is a term that I think people don't really understand. And so they feel a little bit lost whenever they start to read. In today's modern individualistic society, we often view people from the past as out of touch, unnecessary, almost worthless. And that's even if the past is only one or two generations ago. We talk about parents and we say, oh, they're out of touch. They don't really understand us. We think that because of new technology and cultural norms, that they can never understand us. But reading novels and stories of people who live long ago shows us that that's really just not true. People are people, whether they lived in 1500 BC, 0 AD, or 2023 AD. And I think we should understand this more than anybody because we turn to a book that's 2,000 years old, and some of the stories are even older than that if you look at some of the stories in Genesis. And we look at these people and we say, yes, I identify with them. So obviously people from the past can help us to understand something very profound about ourselves. So yes, our perception of the world has changed with technology and with other modern conveniences, but our heart and our tendencies are very similar. So when you read a book, regardless of when it was written, you're not only entering into a conversation with the author, you're entering into a conversation with all of the authors, with all authors out there. So you could think of it, in my mind, it's kind of like a river or a stream. So the great conversation is like a river, you know, of books and thoughts and ideas. And when an author writes something, they're kind of like adding something to that great river. But the thoughts are all kind of existing together, like water, it kind of mixes together. They don't exist by themselves. And the reason why this is important is because one of the best ways to become an expert in a field is to get a book on a topic and then get all the books that that book mentions. And you go through that process until you've gotten a good handle on all the information concerning what you're interested in. I actually did this whenever I first started studying habits and spiritual disciplines. I got the book Habits of the Household. And in that book, you could tell he was a great reader and he referenced lots of other books. And so I got those books and I read them. And now I've read, you know, over 30 books on the topics, and a lot of them come out in this podcast, and I haven't even gotten to all the topics that I read about. But whenever you understand that the books are a conversation between the author and you and the wider thought on that topic, you're going to start to read differently because you'll start to engage with those ideas in a more profound way. One of the ways that I think about this is, you know, if you've ever listened to a sermon and you wanted to go and talk to the pastor and say, hey, this is why you're wrong, or this is why you're totally right. If you've done that, you know that you've listened in a way that's a little bit different than just kind of sitting and nodding your head and waiting until 12 o'clock so that you can move on with your life. Whenever you listen in a way that you want to engage and kind of talk back, you really, I think you internalize those ideas a lot more. And part of that is because you want to explain your position and what you believe. And I think really that's the process of being changed by reading, that you take in ideas, you engage with them, you kind of make a narrative and figure out what you think about them. And then you establish your stance about them and you want to justify your position. And at that point, the reading that you've done has changed you and it's made you into a different person. So I think that's the point of the reading that we do, that we clarify our thoughts and our ideas and who we are by entering into this great conversation. It will also help you understand your reading. Like if you're reading something and, you know, Plato or a quote from Plato pops up and you don't even know who that is, or you've never read anything by him, then you're not going to really understand what the author's trying to say because the author's coming at it from a different standpoint than you. But if you go and read Plato, then you can read this work with an understanding that you're on the common ground. And so I think that's why it's important to understand that writers are all writing to other writers. And so they're all engaging with these ideas. To enter into this conversation means that we need to understand what those authors read in the past. And generally, that might send you on a rabbit trail of reading more and more broadly until you've traced the thread back to, you know, the ancient stories of the Greeks or to fairy tales or great myths of the past. Now, we don't believe everything or even most of what you read, But you learn discernment through engaging with those deep and complex ideas, and you're strengthened, you're sharpened by what you've read. And then in turn, if you're educated well, you can enter into that conversation yourself. So in sum, reading is a habit that you should have. Now, the type of reading I'm talking about is to get away for a few minutes by yourself and engage with a text that challenges you and helps you grow and learn new things. This type of reading, not reading through comments on an Instagram post or scanning a news article, is what will help you think more deeply about yourself and the world. So today, we've really focused more on a bird's eye view of the current state of reading and why reading is important, how reading helps to change us, and a way to think more critically while we read. Now, next week, we're going to get super practical with some suggestions about how to cultivate a reading habit in your life now. So if you enjoyed this podcast today, please subscribe and leave a rating and review wherever you are listening to this podcast. This helps others find the show, and I'll be so grateful for your support. You can find me on Facebook and Instagram, where you can reach out to me and let me know what you think. I'd love for you to join in the conversation. So I'll see you back here next week for the next episode. Thanks so much for joining me at a More Beautiful Life Collective podcast. I hope you go and create a life you love and cultivate your heart for God. I'm Casey Fletcher, and I hope you'll join me next week.